Welcome to Act and Unwind, an ongoing conversation on a free and virtuous society. I'm your host, Eric Cohn. I want to thank you for listening, and I want to ask that if you're listening to us on our website, that you navigate right now to the show notes for this episode, because that's where you'll find a link to subscribe directly to Act and Unwind at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else where you listen to fine podcasts. And if you like this program, please leave us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts so as to help more people find our show. This week, I'm joined by Dan Huger, Acton's librarian and a research associate, and Emily Zanotti, contributing editor here at Acton. This week, we'll be discussing government officials in Brussels trying to shut down the National Conservative Conference that was happening there last week. And an NPR editor speaks out about what he sees as National Public Radio losing its journalistic integrity. But first, on April 10th, Orenthal James Simpson passed away, known mostly to everyone as O.J. Simpson or The Juice. O.J. Simpson was an intriguing figure in American popular cultural history for a lot of reasons. He is undeniably one of the most dominant running backs to have ever played in the National Football League. As we were pointing out before this episode started taping, 1973, the guy averaged 143 yards per game, which is just bonkers. And in true Buffalo Bills, as he played most of his career with the Buffalo Bills style, only saw one playoff game in that period of time. Sorry to all of you Bills fans out there. And then he turns it into this career as a celebrity. People may remember him from the Hertz commercial where he is running through the airport like a running back trying to get to the Hertz counter to rent his car. And I think more people will probably remember him from his acting stint in such great movies as the Naked Gun series, starring alongside Leslie Nielsen, which, of course, he plays a character named Norberg, which is just, again, even just the naming is absolutely hilarious. And he's great and really funny and not a terrific actor, but a quite serviceable actor. And he plays the part quite well. And then everything changes in June of 1994, when it was discovered on the night of June 12th, 94, that Simpson's ex-wife, Nicole Brown, and Ron Goldman were found murdered at Brown's home in Los Angeles. A couple days later, on June 17th, 1994, is the day that most people, if they have a beginning recollection of this saga, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to wait a week to have this conversation, because we're all roughly the same age. We were alive and I think cognizant of what was going on, but like I was 12 years old. It's not like I was watching the entire coverage of the trial, but like this stuff did seep in through osmosis. It's June 17th, 1994, when you have the Bronco chase, the white Bronco chase down the San Diego freeway. There is a really good documentary that I will commend to people, not like the 7.5-hour long OJ one, which I have not watched. That seems a little bit too much OJ, even for a glutton for documentary films like me. But there is an ESPN 30 for 30 documentary that is just titled June 17th, 1994, which catalogs all the different things that were going on at that time. Arnold Palmer playing his final round ever at the United States Open, the commencement of the 94 FIFA World Cup, which was hosted in the United States, game 5 of the 1994 NBA Finals between the Houston Rockets and the New York Knicks, Ken Griffey Jr. tying Babe Ruth's record for most home runs before June 30th. And the reason that I remember that day, which was as a huge New York Rangers hockey fan, the Rangers Stanley Cup Parade happened down the Canyon of Heroes in New York City. And it really is a great documentary because there's no commentary, there's no interviews, it's just the splicing together of all the news coverage of these events. And you just kind of get the feel for just how chaotic and bizarre this day was. The reason that I think this is a conversation worth discussing O.J. Simpson. Of course, O.J., we're discussing this because he passed away last week, is because O.J. Simpson, if he didn't cause a lot of significant changes to American popular culture, the O.J. Simpson trial certainly signified the solidifying of a lot of trends that we are still dealing with. And some of those that I jotted down here, the 24/7 news cycle, the birth of reality television, it is Court TV, really comes into its own broadcasting the O.J. Simpson trial. Like, there are people who were commentators on that are still like living and working today. A woman whose name is escaping me for the moment, who had a Fox News program.
Greta Van Susteren.
Yes.
And Nancy Grace.
Well, reality TV, not just Court TV, of course, but it is the legal dream team of O.J. Simpson that gives us the first introduction to someone with the name Kardashian, which, of course, from a reality TV perspective, we are still living with the consequences of that. It kind of heralds the obsession that we have now with true crime stories. And if you go through the list of the most popular podcasts out there, many of them are true crime stories, arguably one of the most definitively successful limited series podcasts, Serial, from NPR. We'll get to NPR later. Was a true crime story of Sarah Koenig investigating a crime that had already been tried and the person convicted and questioning whether or not this was actually in the interest of justice. The intersection of crime and celebrity, which does have a long history, but the combination of everything that I just listed along with this intersection of crime and celebrity, I think created a new way of looking at that and a new way of living with that. And then you can even get into the possibility of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, I believe is how it's pronounced, CTE, the consequence of concussions and multiple head injuries sustained often by athletes, often by NFL athletes and football players. There's just a whole lot here that the Simpson trial, this whole saga, which, of course, for anybody who is much younger than me and listening to this podcast, even if you don't know the story, I imagine you've heard of it. O.J. Simpson is found not guilty by a jury of his peers in Los Angeles. He, years later, is arrested and convicted for armed robbery and kidnapping in 2007, for which he is sentenced to 33 years in prison. He served 9 years. The penalty was 9 years without parole. He was paroled after those 9 years and then eventually released from parole in 2021. So there's, I think, a lot to unpack here from a cultural perspective, also from the ways that we perceive the criminal justice system within this country. I mean, the argument that was implicitly made at the time was kind of like, yeah, he may have done this, but because of a history of a miscarriage of justice with regard to Black Americans being convicted of things they didn't do, that it was important that O.J. Simpson, even if he did it, got off. Mark Lamont Hill, professor at the City University of New York, essentially blatantly made this point the day that Simpson died, that, you know, he was essentially a traitor to his race, but because of the history of injustices towards Black Americans, it was important that he got off, even though everybody widely believes that he committed these crimes. So, Dan, feel free to take this from, this is kind of a pinata. We can hit it from any angle you want and we'll reap some kind of reward. So take a swing at it from whatever angle interests you the most.
So this is geriatric millennial hour.
Yes, it is.
The way to open this is, you know, I have a younger colleague who I was talking with this morning in the research department, and she said that it was the trial of the century. And my response was that the Lindbergh baby is hardest hit. And when we talk about these sorts of trials, we often lose track of the fact that, you know, there are numerous trials throughout the history of, you know, sort of the world since we've had mass media that have gotten this sort of attention and that have these sort of interlocking parts. I think one of the things that I most vividly remember is I was in middle school at the time this trial was going on, and they announced the verdict over the intercom. The school.
We watched it live.
Oh, boy.
And so I saw that people on Twitter at the time, or at the time of his death, were saying, I can't believe that, like, y'all stopped school to watch this live. And we did. They, like, rolled the TV in, and we watched the jury verdict. I remember I was in social studies class and watched the jury verdict live. And I think because the teachers wanted to watch it, and this was the era before cell phones, so it wasn't like you were going to get a breaking news alert from CNN or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, actually, as a millennial, it kind of changed the course of my life, because that was the first time I encountered forensic science, which is what I ultimately went to college to do. I came out an attorney, but I was so fascinated by the forensic science that happened, or non-forensic science. Mm-hmm. It was pretty stupid, but and rudimentary. But like that case was what motivated me to go to college for that. And then I just eventually just got a law degree, because there was no money in forensic science. And you had to pass a... you had to pass a 90-pound lift and carry to get on the police force. And that was never going to happen. but yeah, I mean, we watched it. I still can't believe we did that. I don't think we watched any other major news event live in school that I can remember, other than Challenger and...
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up, though. Like, I think for the same kind of generation of teachers, the having showed so many kids the Challenger disaster, of course, unintentionally showing them the explosion of this space shuttle, is one of the reasons that, like, that kind of things that are happening live. Like, I don't remember, again, I went to the small Catholic school in the Metro East area of Illinois. I do not remember, like, finding out what the verdict was, and I guess until I got home that day. So, but even again, Emily, to your point, driving home, that connection between popular culture, celebrity, and the events of this trial, what do we get just, you know, a decade later? One of the most popular shows on television is CSI. Do you get CSI without the fascination with procedural crime and true crime stuff that we got as an outflow from the O.J. Simpson trial? I mean, I don't know
and
if we
do. The characters from the trial continued to persist, which is, I think, the difference between... You know, so Leopold and Loeb, of course, you have characters in that continue to pop up throughout history. But and the Lindbergh baby trial, of course, Charles Lindbergh is notable. But this is the start of reality television. Yeah. Nancy Grace continues to be on TV. Greta Van Susteren ultimately gets her own show. She's like on right after Bill O'Reilly at the beginning of this cable news / entertainment situation. Then you have Robert Kardashian, who goes on to tragically die, and his children then become reality television stars. Mm-hmm. There's also
Mark Furman, former police officer.
Jerry Spence, who was the guy with the fringe jacket, the Western looking lawyer who persisted as a legal consultant forever. Dan Abrams, who was the legal consultant at CNN, I think, at the time, and then now has gone on to found his own network based almost entirely on crime journalism. And then you have, say, O.J. Simpson, who never, pardon the pun, let it die. He came out with a book that said, "If I did it," and recounted how he would have killed his ex-wife. So it's just, there's people involved in this that didn't allow it to sort of go under the radar, like the Lindbergh trial or the Scopes Monkey trial or Leopold and Loeb. Those are all really important trials, but those people are now part of the history books, whereas we're still dealing with, like, Nancy Grace on a regular basis today.
So this was also a trial that, you know, when they make this announcement over the intercom during gym class, there are 13-year-old boys and girls that respond by booing and cheering. And no one doesn't do one or the other. And that is because this tribe, just as these figures, these personalities are with us, a lot of these issues remain with us. This is a trial that happened in the wake of the LA riots. You had issues of, you know, police tampering with evidence. This wasn't a trial. This was formally a trial of O.J. Simpson, but this was also a trial of the Los Angeles Police Department and a trial of the justice system writ large. And this animated everyone's reactions to it. And, you know, they found people to root for in this. The interesting thing is almost no one, other than perhaps the jury themselves, really believed he didn't do it. Even those folks who cheered with O.J.'s acquittal were not cheering for, you know, the exoneration of an innocent man, but were cheering for the indictment of a justice system and a police department. And that sort of polarization is something that persists, and this inability to sort of keep our eyes on the ball is also something that has persisted. And the justice system, which in a free society should be about keeping our eye on the ball, is now about anything but.
One of the things that I find fascinating is, as I pointed out in my introduction, the O.J. Simpson trial, a lot of what has flowed out of it, it's not, as is often the case, it is not the first incident of a lot of these things. You can find, for example, I just had to Google this to find out, but it was the Klaus von Bülow trial was the first one to be televised, which was in 1982. However, it really is, it's the combination of factors of cable television, of, you know, no longer really having a broadcast system where your television would sign, the networks would sign off for the evening and there'd be nothing on for like 4 hours. You had this 24/7 media cycle in order to fill. You had networks like CNN dedicated to news coverage 24/7. You had the birth of court TV dedicated to the criminal justice system news and events 24/7. And it really is the crystallization, the formation of these things as kind of permanent entities that we continue to live with. And you still see this now kind of in arguments. Somebody pointed out on a podcast I was listening to, Emily, you mentioned the Scopes Monkey trial. That was broadcast on the radio. There is a history of some kind of broadcasting of actual trial proceedings. We get this in debates now over you can listen to the audio of Supreme Court arguments, and there is a push to put cameras in the Supreme Court to televise Supreme Court hearings. I am diametrically opposed to that idea. I think you see what happens when you put cameras on people, and it is not a coincidence that the real birth of reality television comes alongside and after the O.J. Simpson trial. And one of the things that we have learned and should have learned from this experience is when you put cameras on people, they act differently. They play to a different audience. And this is one of the concerns that I have from a legal, procedural, criminal justice perspective of putting cameras in courtrooms is you get what you got from the defense team in the O.J. Simpson trial, which was, yes, they were appealing to the jury, but they were also speaking to and appealing to the general audience that was watching this with the kind of, yeah, I mean, you could see this played out in, say, like the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis, where there are questions because of all the public attention that if the verdict went one way or the other way, there's the possibility of riots happening because it was televised nationally, because there was all of this attention being put on it, because there were these race elements. The jury additionally had to weigh, even though it was supposed to be out of their purview, what is the consequence of a verdict of guilty for the national landscape, and what is the consequence of a verdict of not guilty? I don't think this is a good development. And I don't think we should continue expanding it. I think we have seen the development of putting cameras in more places and people being recorded on a regular basis changes one's behavior. I mean, there's a whole Chuck Klosterman essay on the real world and Road Rules, which were these first two big reality television programmings, which, of course, the networks love because they're very cheap to produce. And you just put cameras in front of people, and unsurprisingly, they change their behavior to play it up for the camera. Why people think this would be any different in courtrooms, why people think this would be any different in legislatures, I mean, I think we need to ask ourselves the question. On one hand, you could say—
Trial advocacy uses this as a strategy. Like, when you go to law school, trial advocacy is a separate system of learning than, say— written advocacy. And trial advocacy does give you elements of showmanship. And previously to, you know, the cameras and appealing to the cameras, there were things that people did in front of juries that made them, you know, more sympathetic. So you have Dr. Phil, you guys all know Dr. Phil as a reality TV guy. But prior to Dr. Phil's life on Oprah, his entire job was to teach defense attorneys how to appeal directly to the emotions of people on a jury. So he would be hired by either a plaintiff or a defendant, and in this case, Oprah, and he would work with their legal team to profile out the jurors and determine exactly what each juror would find problematic or what would sway that juror on an emotional level. And so that became an entire industry before there were cameras in a courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is defense attorneys used to like wear threadbare jackets and look like they were poor, or they'd appeal to juries on a public policy angle. On the hopes that they would say that acquit a defendant because they disagreed with the marijuana laws rather than the fact that this person clearly was not guilty of possession of marijuana. This is a taught thing. And then when you add cameras into the courtroom, then that becomes a way of making sure that you have this sort of jury nullification. So no matter what the jury reaches, the public will have to reach a similar conclusion. So that would really throw the Supreme Court, because you already have contentious issues that go in front of the Supreme Court, and then you would have people playing it up in order to get further fuel on that fire. It would be a disaster.
One more point on the proliferation of cameras. This was kind of driven home to me again. I watched a couple weeks ago this movie. I guess I'd watched once before, but I'd completely forgotten about, called Parkland, which is a dramatic retelling of the events around the Kennedy assassination from the perspective of different people involved in it. Paul Giamatti plays Abraham Zapruder, of course, filmed it, and Billy Bob Thornton plays Forrest Sorrells, who's the head of the Dallas office of the Secret Service, and you follow the doctors who operated both on Kennedy and then a couple days later on Lee Harvey Oswald. But what stuck out to me was Kennedy is giving a couple of speeches. He's doing a campaign tour through Texas. And for some reason, it stuck out to me that this kind of thing doesn't happen anymore and can't happen anymore. You only have one message that can be delivered because of the proliferation of recording devices. Everybody's going to be able to access whatever you said. Whereas, you know, Kennedy going and speaking at the Trade Mart in Dallas has a specific message that he wants to deliver to those people. And nobody outside of that room is really going to hear it. It may be reported on a day later in the newspapers, but really only in the Dallas local newspapers. It's not going to be something that's going to necessarily appear in the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune or the LA Times. And now you have everything that happens is everywhere all at once, right? It's the Bo Burnham line, can I interest you in everything all of the time? And that has changed the way that people behave and the way that they perform. And the point I was going to make about, you know, the legislative bodies is I think we need to ask ourselves, have we been well served by putting cameras in Congress? Is C-SPAN on one hand showing us how these things actually function can be absolutely considered a public service, but it has changed the way that legislative body functions because the cameras are in the room. And even if this isn't the first case in the OJ trial, that it the first time that we were televising a trial like this, it is certainly the one where all this crystallized and the path we were on afterwards was a different one.
I mean, the challenge is communication is almost always contextual. And it's there's a whole structure of relationships, shared history, shared future that's involved in it a lot of times. And when you abstract and flatten that out, that means that certain forms of communication that could happen, that maybe should happen, that maybe need to happen in certain institutional contexts can no longer happen because the conditions for those sorts of that sort of communication and the relationships that come out of that sort of communication and that sort of relationship no longer carry. And I think that's behind a whole lot of problems in a whole lot of our institutions today.
Let's move on to our second topic. Let me read here from a piece in Politico, and not just any Politico, the European version of Politico. Dateline Brussels. Europe's nationalists came to Brussels to pick a fight with the EU superstate, only to end up fighting a local mayor. In all likelihood, a meeting of Europe's hard right, featuring Nigel Farage and Viktor Orban as its keynote speakers, wouldn't have garnered much global attention. But attempts by three local politicians to shut down the National Conservatism Conference triggered international outcry, handing the European Union arch critics more ammunition than they could have dreamed of 2 months before the European election. So this is a local mayor, Emir Kerr, who attempted to stop the conference by arguing it represented a danger to the public, a move ultimately quashed by a Belgian court, backfired. Rather, it emboldened a growing right-wing caucus that stands to gain seats and influence in coming months, not least of which in Belgium, where Flemish nationalist separatists Vlaams Belang, pardon if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, are projected to become the largest Belgian party in the European Parliament and win the country's national elections in June. So this, if the National Conservatism Conference sounds familiar, it may be because you have read Dan Huger's coverage of the American versions of the National Conservatism Conference. I will point out that it is kind of fascinating to me that when I go to the National Conservatism website and I look at conferences, 2022 was NatCon 3 in Miami. And I believe NatCon 4 is supposed to be coming for like 2 years now, and it's still not happened in Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, this is the second time they've been in Brussels. They were in 2023 in London, had a conference there, which to me is kind of interesting and instructive of the way that the people involved in this movement see this movement, that this kind of national conservatism is a multinational phenomenon that's happening in places like Europe. They've previously had conferences in Brussels and Rome as well as the United States. And you get this kind of conflation of the where we used to draw lines between the ideas of conservatism, that in America, conservatism is conserving a liberal American revolution that founded this country. And the kind of conservatism you would get in Europe would be different in nature and character because of the things they're trying to conserve. It's how you get F.A. Hayek's Why I'm Not a Conservative that really isn't addressed at American conservatives at the time he wrote it as much as it is addressed at European conservatives who are conservative of, you know, throne and altar, blood and soil type conservatism. But, you know, I think kind of undeniably, Dan, the NatCon people couldn't have asked for anything better to happen to them than this incident to drive home the kinds of points that they would like to make.
So there's layers and layers and layers to this onion. One of the things that I think is important is to realize is that national conservatism is a mainstream political phenomenon in Europe and has been for decades, well before we had this attempt to sort of do a national conservatism America style. You've had parties in Austria, who have in Switzerland, in all sorts of places in Central Europe and Eastern Europe, where national conservative parties have been either governing parties themselves, such as in Hungary today with Prime Minister Orban's party, or have been parts of coalitions. You have had, you know, multi-generations of Le Pens in France who have come in second for the French presidency. This is not a new phenomena, and this actually has an infrastructure with real political parties.
Another name we should probably throw in there as well, Geert Wilders. I remember hearing about Geert Wilders back in the 2000s as one of the hardline anti-Islamist politicians in Europe.
So we have this, and then we have this layer where we have this Belgian mayor. Now, Brussels has many, many mayors that cover various sort of neighborhoods in the city. And this mayor is interesting in a number of accounts. One is that he was expelled from the Socialist Party in Belgium. Why? Because of his ties to Turkish nationalists and the Grey Wolves group. So you have a clash of sort of nationalist visions. And you have a question, you know, the argument made, the conference had trouble securing a venue in Brussels. And in fact, this final venue was secured very late. The other interesting twist to this story is this hotel and conference space that they ended up using was owned and operated by a Tunisian immigrant to Belgium, who the National Conservatives, to their credit, thanked from the stage for his hosting the conference, because it was very difficult for them to secure a venue. There was a public safety concern that the mayor of this particular area of Brussels had expressed, failed to materialize. There was no violence, no disruption whatsoever. And this was, you know, a case where a local government official saw an opportunity to score political points with his constituency. The National Conservatives are now reaping the benefits of that by scoring points with their own constituencies, confirming the fears that people had of the European Union. The irony is this conference resumed the next day because an attorney from the Alliance Defending Freedom International made an argument in front of a Belgian court on grounds of Belgian law that this conference should be allowed to proceed. Liberal institutions made the continuance of this conference happen in spite of abuse of local power, and it was corrected within 24 hours. You didn't need to act outside of those institutions. You didn't need to transcend. You didn't need strong, muscly national conservatives to have the will to make it happen. You needed a decision by a judge that was argued on their case was argued by an attorney according to the rule of law.
I mean, to me, this is nothing new. I mean, it will continue to happen because it's just, as long as Europe has been around, there's been these factions. We have more factions, more defined factions in Europe than we do in the United States. And Europe is facing a crisis that we are only sort of starting to face. They've been struggling with radicalization. They've been struggling with immigration. They've been struggling with changes to the foundational principles of their governments for a very long time. And this is just the latest and newest way of handling these. It's impressive that the conference managed to go on. But I think that the longer that these parties stick around, the more aggressive they're going to be, just because of the way that you see Americans sort of responding more when immigration starts to hit home, or they start to connect the dots on what happens when people come over borders and are just sort of bussed into cities and left there without an administration. Europe has been dealing with this for a very long time, and it's hard for us, I think, to comprehend why this would occur even in Europe. But you know, it's a first line of defense sort of place, and you know, it's actually pretty impressive. And it happened anyway, which in the United States, we might have had 6 days of a news cycle on this one, though, with everybody having to make a speech.
Yeah, the point that you make, Dan, I think is the one that I find most interesting, is the overlap in the Venn diagram between the people who claim the national conservatism mantle and the people who claim the mantle of post-liberalism is not a circle, but there is a significant overlap there. And there's this kind of, you know, I think as I put it on Twitter in regards to comments from Notre Dame professor Patrick Deneen, as opposed to Nietzsche's philosophizing with a hammer, Deneen engages in when all you have is a hammer philosophizing, which is when everything to you that you dislike is the consequence of liberalism, then of course the answer is post-liberalism. But this is the same kind of category error that I see being made by these post-liberals on a regular basis, which is their problem is not liberalism. It is illiberalism. I am opposed to that as well. And the reason that they should know that the problem is not liberalism is because I am a liberal and I am on their side when it comes to a lot of these issues. I do not want to see. I think a lot of the views of a lot of the people at these national conservatism conferences, I find somewhere between ridiculous and odious, and I want them to have their conference, and I want people to hear what they have to say. It is, you know, kind of this engaging in this belief that if we allow people to hear views that we think are bad, they will just immediately fall under their sway, and you know, we're kind of off to the races in some kind of disaster that is going to come as a result of it. When you know, people are a lot more complex than that. It is not nearly that simple. And the idea of just you know, if we just don't allow people to hear the National Conservatism Conference in Brussels, then people in Europe are not going to have these kinds of beliefs. And as Emily detailed, there's a long history of all of that stuff. And the idea that if we just stop the National Conservatism Conference from happening, that these views are going to disappear is frankly ludicrous. But again, the problem is, to me, like it is this constantly looking at every problem that is caused by illiberalism, the idea that you know there isn't a natural right to freedom of speech and freedom of expression, that these people should not allow to be heard, that is vindicated in the courts. Systems set up under an understanding of liberalism, this kind of the thing we get poo-pooed all the time. There's just procedural liberalism, as if this has no moral value imbued in it whatsoever. The idea that people deserve their day in court, that the presumption is on the side of the accused, has a whole lot of moral value. And these people somehow look at these incidences of illiberalism and like Patrick Deneen just kind of go, is this liberalism? Like, no. No, it's not. It is liberalism that vindicated the right of these people to hold their conference. I am with you in opposing the kind of illiberalism that is being visited upon them, and I wish that they would, like, I'm on their side, but they're not.
Maybe the question—
I think when you start to align there, it becomes a problem. So you see this sort of happening with Christian nationalism in the United States. Oh, I will, because everybody hates them and they hate me, well, I guess me and them are in the same boat. Well, no, that's not true. You don't want to be in the same boat as sort of neo-paganism. You don't want to be in the same boat as Christian nationalism. You don't want to be in the same boat as these. Just because everybody hates them doesn't mean they hate you. You are very different from them. And you need to continue to delineate that, you know, this is one thing and I am one thing. And those boundaries have to be drawn. I mean, William F. Buckley had that with the John Birch Society. Just because we're on the same general side as the John Birch Society does not mean you get to lump me in with the John Birch Society and discredit all of our ideas. But the best way to do that is to let them speak, because they will show you who they are. They are not proud of their beliefs. And so when you look at what happens with the NatCon conference, they went all out. They talked about it. There is this sort of bizarre neo-paganism, or this idea that the period right after post-World War II is some sort of ideal civilization. You know, that's what led to the problems in Fallout, right? I mean, we like, for those of you watching that, like, there will not be, there is no timescape where you get stuck in 1962 and everything is always great. But they sort of have convinced themselves of this, and they've convinced themselves that this modern paganism is also what should be. So they'll tell you what they believe. You just have to let them tell you.
Well, it's also a very acute form of nostalgia with amnesia about all of the bad parts of it. Because as we were kind of joking before the program started recording today, that, you know, for people who want to lionize the 1950s and all of that, you know, there's, you know, the amount of like things like spousal abuse and racism that happened and sexism that occurred in the 1950s.
I really like having my own credit card.
Yeah, that's probably a good thing in general. You know, the joke used to be that the left wanted to work in the 1950s and the right wants to live there, and is increasingly true that the right wants to both live and work in the 1950s. But, you know, Emily, to the point that you were making there too, the idea that we're going to be able to recreate that kind of an environment necessitates something that nobody really wants, which is the destruction of most of Europe and a lot of the Pacific Asian countries because of a giant world war, the second one to occur in several decades, that made America like the only place that could do the kind of manufacturing, product production, that ship stuff all around the world. It made us very rich. It made us very well off. It created a lot of great things. But the problem is, it's like that you know, Bugs Bunny Daffy Duck cartoon where they're both performing and trying to one up each other. And as his like final big, you know, production, Daffy Duck basically blows himself up. And Bugs is like, "That's fantastic! Like, they want you to do it again." He's like, "That's the problem. You can only do it once." You can't recreate that environment. And this is like, again, we've gotten into the political views of a lot of the people at this kind of conference. But I think that's the fatal flaw, is that they are pointing back to a time that can't be replicated. We can learn lessons from it, but we can't replicate it exactly. And that kind of nostalgia just seems to me to be completely like just writ through in this movement.
So this is the question that Americans need to consider when they're considering, you know, what is the future of the American conservative movement look like? And one of the sort of rally cries for the national conservative folks in an American context is for them to talk about historic movement conservatism and ask the question, what has conservatism conserved? And, you know, there are genuine failures of the American conservative movement. I think there's genuine successes as well. But I think it's important to ask also that, you know, we're 25, 30 years into national conservative parties in Europe playing a real role in the political processes there. And I think it's important for Americans when they look at this European context is to say, what has national conservatism conserved? You have a case where, like, you know, Emily is right to point out the many, many challenges that Europe faces. And if you look at a place like the United Kingdom that withdrew from the European Union, all of those problems are still there. Questions of immigration, questions of integration, questions of freedom of speech, none of that went away because they didn't report to Brussels anymore. These are issues that every nation is having to struggle with, and there's no magic bullet that gets away from the hard wrestling that everybody has to do with these things.
And that wrestling often has to be done on a national level, not a European Union level. So the way that immigrants are treated, it's a proximity issue, right? So people are showing up by the boatloads in Italy. They're showing up by the boatloads in Italy. They're taking the trains to France. They're taking the train to London. They're showing up by boatloads in London and Spain. Every individual country then also has whether you're going to welcome these people or not. And Italy is increasingly terrified of these people because they all tend to be men, young men of military age washing up on their shores, and they're not quite sure exactly what's happening right now. Is this legitimate? Where are they coming from? What conflicts are producing this level of immigration? Is it conflicts, or are they being told they can come to Europe? So there's all of these sort of low-level policy issues, because then when you go to France, when you get to France, says you cannot be a French citizen unless you integrate, and if you don't integrate, you're ghettoized. And when you're ghettoized, you don't have a job, you basically live off the state, and that has a tendency to radicalize. Then they go to Germany, it's different. They go to Belgium, it's different. They go to Spain, it's different. And some people have it easier than others. So this isn't an EU problem. It's an individualized sort of country-based problem. And yes, is Hungary dealing with it a certain way? Yeah. But is that replicable across Europe? Probably not. Is it replicable in the United States? Probably not. Is it working for the long term in Hungary? We don't know. So it's kind of one of these where you're just putting a lot of stock in some ideas and some slogans and not really looking for whether they're going to be productive on the end level or whether they're even good for society on an end level. Just, we feel good about this. And increasingly, you know, we feel like politics is just a we feel good about this kind of exercise. And that's where your problems start to come in.
One final point. I agree, Emily, with everything that you just said. I think, again, from my understanding, an American living in the Midwest, looking at issues relating to the European Union, I had a couple of friends who were Brexit campaigners in the UK. I found myself, I think I used to describe myself as mildly inclined to their position, but at the end of the day, not thoroughly persuaded. That the point that I want to make is there are no there are no unalloyed goods and there are no alloyed bads in the world. Everything is kind of a mixed bag. And when you look at the European Union, you know, my friends who are the Brexit campaigners can give you chapter and verse for all of the insane kinds of things that this supranationalist power was, you know, visiting upon the various countries, you know, the stories of regulating the size of bananas and like the type of cheese that can only be called a certain type of cheese if it comes from this region, you know, otherwise it's like, you know, sparkling Parmesan or whatever, I don't know. But the one of the main objectives of the European Union was to stop the continent from getting consumed in a massive war every few decades. They've been largely successful in that effort. And I don't think we should overlook that too. You know, it's like your history gets you to the environment that you are in. And yes, if Europe could have managed to avoid having a giant war, not only that consumed the continent, but two of them that consumed, again, the rest of the world, that set the stage for the kind of 1950s, you know, America that we were just discussing, then perhaps it wouldn't have been necessary to form this kind of supranational government in Europe. But how we got there necessitated some kind of an entity, at least the view of the people involved, that was going to help try to prevent that kind of incident from happening again. And again, they've been largely successful. They haven't been, you know, this perfect thing. They haven't been perfectly awful either. So I think there's these things are often a lot more complicated than people want to give them credit for. But to be fair, it's complicated doesn't make a very good bumper sticker slogan.
If you could solve the riddle of aligning German and French interests, you've solved a riddle that bedeviled literally,
yes,
literally all of Europe.
Centuries. Centuries.
Centuries.
Yeah.
And like, if you could just align French and German tourists somewhere, that gets you a peace prize. Like, if you could just convince Germany of, you know, not everybody needs to be nude on a beach, and the French that everybody should wear deodorant. Like, there's just things that make America great compared to some other countries. But, like, you just, these cultures are not going to change overnight.
Yeah.
They're going to go to war. They've been doing The other great
accomplishment is the integration of former Soviet bloc countries into a juridical framework that respects the rule of law, expanding market economies in these situations. You look at Poland, in a generation, Poland is going to have the living standards of the United Kingdom, if not surpass it, depending on just how bad governance in the UK gets. But like, that's a major accomplishment.
Let's move to our final topic. On April 9th, The Free Press, Barry Weiss's very interesting and intriguing publication, published a piece from Uri Berliner, who is a senior business editor at National Public Radio, entitled, I've been at NPR for 25 years. Here's how we lost America's trust. And in this piece, Berliner makes a number of arguments. It's a lengthy piece. So we'll put it in the show notes for people to read. But essentially, it makes the argument that they've lost the public trust by moving away from its original mission of providing unbiased news to becoming a platform that promotes a specific worldview. Berliner, who, as I noted, had been there for 25 years, we'll get to that in a moment, criticized the network for telling listeners how to think rather than presenting balanced news coverage. He claims that NPR has prioritized diversity and inclusion initiatives over viewpoint diversity, leading to the exclusion of conservative perspectives. He points out several instances where he believes NPR's coverage, according to him, has been biased. He criticizes the network for overplaying the investigation into Russian collusion with the Trump campaign in the 2016 presidential election, underplaying the story of Hunter Biden's laptop, and failing to adequately cover the origins of the COVID-19 virus and the Israel-Hamas conflict. Berliner also argues that NPR's focus on identity and race has become paramount in nearly every aspect of the workplace, further contributing to its loss of trust among the public. This sparked quite a debate, and the end result of this is that Uri Berliner was suspended for 5 days at NPR for, again, having published with an entity outside of NPR without getting permission ahead of time. It was a 5-day suspension without pay. In the midst of that suspension, he announced his resignation from NPR. So that is that situation as it currently stands. Emily, you worked in news media for a good long while. I don't know if you were ever much of an NPR listener. I will confess to having been a pretty regular NPR listener at one point in time.
I am, but not for its news.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. So like I've always liked This American Life. I think that that is a fantastic program. I love Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I still like that program to this day.
I've been several times to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me live. I
was telling Dan this actually the other day, but I contributed to the pledge drive at NPR years ago when I was living in Chicago. And the reward for contributing above a certain level was tickets to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is all around pretty good. Like I got a panel of Faith Saley, Mo Rocca, and PJ O'Rourke. But by one day, I missed guest host Tom Hanks by one day. But I agree with you. But when I listened to it and listened to like Morning Edition on a regular basis, what I had always liked about NPR is I recognized that they had their biases, right? A lot of the way that we talk about bias, I think, is misinformed because we think of it as this kind of purposefully shading the coverage in one certain direction where it becomes these more subconscious things in reality is the way that bias infuses this kind of news coverage. It's in story selection. It's the things you choose to focus on. And the evolution around the time of the COVID pandemic, as well as the George Floyd incident, really precipitated a slant to their news coverage that was, I would tune in to find out how every issue, no matter how innocuous I thought it was actually a race issue. So I think there's a lot of stuff in Uri Berliner's piece that resonated with me as someone who did listen to NPR. What did you make of Berliner's piece and the reaction to it?
I think it exposed something that maybe a lot of people in the media industry aren't aware of, and that is that institutional bias becomes a problem after a while. You just live and work around people who think like you for so long that you don't realize that you've just sort of sunk deeper and deeper and deeper into this self-serving circle. So like with NPR, I think the content often has been great. I've listened to a lot of NPR. I think the podcasts that NPR produces are great. But the news department just sort of sunk deeper and deeper into its own narcissism in some way. Like, it just felt like at one point in time, NPR was told that it was this amazing, unbiased news source because it's funded by the public rather than by a corporate media empire. And it was told that it was more believable because of that. And so they just started to believe their own PR, and it created this vicious cycle that got them to this point. And it's much easier, I think, at that point to sort of say, well, this one person who spoke out is wrong, rather than to take an introspective look at the news media organization itself and say, well, maybe we are a little too deep. But one thing about the news organizations and news industry now is that so much of it is very similar to the way that social media runs, which is you do it for clicks, or you do it for, in this case, donations. And so you also have a vicious cycle with donors. The further left you went, the more money you got. Eventually, people stopped contributing because, you know, Prairie Home Companion is no longer part of it. This American Life you can get as a podcast now.
Car Talk, so, no longer.
Car Talk, no longer. And the things that were happening on weekend days and what have you, they're just sort of podcasts now. Mm-hmm. So the only thing left to listen to on NPR was the news. And then the only people listening to the news were also contributing. And you would meet the contributors, and those contributors would be on the far left. And the more that they contributed, the more farther left you got. So it's a vicious cycle that affects them just the same way it affects, you know, Fox News or various small level ideological news departments, even NBC News, CBS News. Those things just become echo chambers.
I was a long, long time NPR listener. And one of my favorite campus controversies when I was at Hillsdale College is I had a good friend that wrote an editorial called Why I Want to Be an NPR Liberal. And this is now 20 years ago. And the reason he wanted to be an NPR liberal is he wanted to be deeply engaged with the arts, culture, news internationally. He wanted to have a broadness of vision and openness to questions. And I was thinking about this, as Eric told me about this topic, because right now, like, I have stopped listening to NPR because I don't want to listen to the top 10 countdown of America's coming race war. It is totally divorced from reality. It feels like sometimes that I'm listening to excerpts from the Turner Diaries. Like, it is monomaniacal in its obsessions about race, gender, and sexuality. I long for the days when we would have a strong left-wing environmental angle to reporting. I want some anti-capitalism. They don't even have that anymore. It is just identity politics.
It's just real communism in its purest form. Like, I want everything that NPR is. I want to be the elderly white lady with the ridiculous haircut who has a hate has no home here sign in front of her house, drives a Subaru, and works on her garden and screams at people to get off her lawn. I want to be the Elizabeth Warren NPR listener, right? Like, that is the archetype. And suddenly now it's like college freshmen, right, who have to listen to NPR between Palestine protests. Like, it's gone off the rails.
I remember being at Newberry Library in Chicago for the Bughouse Square debates, which, Emily, I don't know if you ever attended that when you were in Chicago, but it was always like just quite a scene. I remember to describe that former archetype, there was a woman with, you know, the local NPR button on her tote bag, which was, you know, an NPR tote bag, and the T-shirt she was wearing said Deephave Lakeshore Drive. And I just thought that was such a perfect summation of like an archetype that I had yet to really encounter in the wild. But the
I want to go to foreign films at a small theater in Evanston and shop from the Signals catalog.
And admittedly, like some of this stuff again, like was what I was interested in. And I think Dan, you raise a really good point there by what you bring up, that you have this transition on the American left where race replaced class as the way of understanding everything important in the world, particularly in this country. And I think you see that well represented in NPR's coverage over the last couple of years. And the last thing I will note as well is the interesting timing of this whole story. Around the same time that this woman, Catherine Marr, who formerly had been the CEO at Wikimedia, becomes the CEO at National Public Radio. So, of course, people – and you know, again, this is an argument tying it back to kind of some of the cultural shift stuff that we were talking about in the first segment about O.J. Simpson. Because she's been online for so long, because she's tweeted about so many things, people go spelunking through her tweets and find these ones that basically sound like they were created by a modern radical left-wing AI chatbot. Like, she's just perfectly out of central casting for, like, if you asked Christopher Rufo to imagine what the next CEO of NPR would be like, he would imagine Catherine Marr. Like, he would invent her if she did not exist. And I think the lack of recognition that anything could possibly be wrong at NPR that you have seen in the reaction to Uri Berliner's piece is part and parcel of the problem, that these entities, to Emily's point, they do not do introspection. The idea that, you know, the NPR, because it has both government funding and is listener funded, is going to be somehow more independent than a company that takes advertising from major corporations is just belied by all of the evidence that we have in front of us. There's a great exchange in the movie Thank You for Smoking where Senator Finister, played by William H. Macy, tries to excoriate Aaron Eckhart for the tobacco companies and the money they contribute to the Academy for Tobacco Studies, which of course is influencing what the Academy for Tobacco Studies is putting out. He says, no, we're not influenced that, just as I'm sure you're not influenced by campaign contributions, right? It's like everybody is subject to these kinds of influences, but it's the lack of introspection and the lack of any possible understanding of the way that they have changed over time, I think, is the problem. And I don't know that there's anything to suggest that it's going to get better at National Public Radio. Although, again, as a former listener, I really wish it would, because I kind of miss that time period.
I do. And the Tiny Desk concerts are still good.
But those you can are get great. Them on TikTok. Yes.
You can get them on TikTok.
Exactly.
So like, there's so much that I can consume. But I had almost that identical conversation with my father-in-law, who was like, he showed up and he started talking about how Israel should, you know, pull out of Gaza, all these things that I was just like, what? And I said, where did you get all of this? Thinking that he'd been listening to MSNBC. Yes. Oh, NPR. It's like NPR.
Yeah.
He's like, it is, you know, I said, no, this is wrong. This is wrong. Like, objectively, you're allowed to have your own opinions, but I'm like, this is factually wrong and factually wrong. Well, NPR is the most trustworthy of all news sources. Like, yeah, sure. Okay.
I mean, of all of the purveyors of race communism, NPR is by far the most legitimate.
Yes. Yes.
The hardest working purveyor of race communism in the news.
Yeah. Today. I mean, the Turner Diaries does not have Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It just doesn't.
That'll be their next podcast. Peter Sagal reads the Turner Diaries. With apologies to Peter Sagal, who I think is delightful, and I love that program. So
maybe Garrison Keillor.
Yeah.
What's doing a lot?
I can't get us out of here without making the joke of like Homer Simpson watching the like Prairie Home Companion thing on television is like, stupid TV, be more funny. that is what I will forever think of when I hear Prairie Home Companion. But let's call it a wrap there. Thank you for listening to Act and Unwind. If you're listening to this podcast on our website, please look in the show notes where you'll find a link where you can subscribe directly to Act and Unwind, or just search Act and Unwind on your favorite podcast app. Also, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, 5-star reviews only, so that more people can find our show. Thanks to Dan. Thanks to Emily. For the Acton Institute, I'm Eric Cohn. We'll see you next week.